when a country says we're going to dominate AI by 2030, which China has said, it makes me anxious because it suggests it's already using the rhetoric of the Cold War. It's already using the rhetoric of an arms race. And that's very sobering.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. This is the artificial intelligence, or AI, episode. Though, as you may have already guessed, it's not going to be the kind of utopian, anything-is-possible take on the subject that you get on popular media and corporate websites. My guest is James Barrett, filmmaker and author of the book Our Final Invention. It's one of the most sobering takes on the subject of AI that you'll find anywhere. I started off by asking him what got him interested in AI in the first place.
I made a film years ago about AI, and I interviewed Ray Kurzweil, who's a Thomas Edison award winner. He's an inventor. He's now one of the chief engineers at Google. I interviewed Rodney Brooks, who's probably the premier roboticist of our time. He created iRobot and the Roomba vacuum cleaner, and now he's got a company called Rethink Robotics. And both of those guys were really positive about the time to come when we share the planet with machines that are smart and smarter than we are. And they thought that we'll grow with them and they'll be our intelligent companions. But then I interviewed Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction legend.
Yeah, of 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Exactly. And he was not so much. Intelligence will win out in whatever form. We humans steer the planet not because we're the fastest or the strongest creature, but because we're the most intelligent. When we share the planet with smarter than human machines, they will steer the future.
So at one point, Clark actually made you think that maybe not everything is going to be rosy and positive with the future of artificial intelligence.
Yes, I was really smitten with AI, and I still am. I think it's a wonderful technology with enormous potential in every aspect of our lives. But he planted a seed of doubt that I started to kind of pay attention to, and I followed up with AI makers, people that program AI. And they pretty much, I asked them all one question. This was years ago before I started writing the book. I said, in 100 years, will machines make the most important decisions in our lives? And 100% of those people said yes. And I said, so the question that became the subject of my book was, will that be a handover or a takeover? Mm-hmm. Will we give our volition and our choices to machines, or will at some point the machines just take our will, take our free will, make the decisions? And will we lose control of machines that are thousands or millions of times more intelligent than we are?
So the consensus was, yes, they will. And if that's being the case, what's at stake?
Well, the consensus was, yes, they will. But the debate is about how, is it a handover or a takeover? Mm. And so what's at stake is in the short term, as Stephen Hawking said, the trouble with AI in the short term is who controls it. The trouble in the long term is, can it be controlled at all? And when you hear people like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and Bill Gates talk about losing control of machines that are much more intelligent than we are, they're talking about what we're calling the control problem. Because the thing is, we have no experience creating a technology that can outsmart us. We can use our own evolution as kind of an example. Our secret superpower, our superpower as humans, is our intelligence. Mm. If we create machines that become smarter than we are, then we've lost our superpower. We've given it to the machines.
James, just to get break this down a little bit, let's talk about AI. AI is more of a concept than it is a technology per se, right? It's the way of looking at the way technology will evolve. It's computer processing power to exceed the capabilities of the human brain. But there's lots of variations on this across right. different industries and sectors. Can you just explain what's at stake and why is there so much buzz around AI particularly?
Okay, well, AI is many things. There are many AI techniques. AI is a science. And really what the science is about is mirroring aspects of human cognition in machines. So you get very good visual perception. You get very good navigation. You get very good translation, theorem proving. You get very good search, knowledge retrieval, all the things we do with our brain. And that's what's really fascinating about AI to me, is that we're really recreating ourselves in machines. So there are a lot of techniques and there are a lot of really good applications for business and personal use. But what's happening in the short term, we're finding bad actors using AI for bad ends. The National Security Agency stole the data for basically millions of citizens, and then they mine that data using AI mining techniques. And now they've got your phone book and my phone book and all our contacts. Facebook just sold all our data to Cambridge Analytica, which sold it to Russia, which used it to influence an election. These are bad actors using AI for bad ends. That's the short-term problem.
So if data is the fuel, then there's an algorithm which actually allows machines to leverage that data to then think forward or forecast outcomes and possibilities. Is that right?
That's sort of one version of what intelligence is. Some people think that intelligence is simply the ability to anticipate the future, and that's why we have big brains. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. Intelligence, one good definition, is the ability to achieve goals in a variety of environments and to learn. So it has to be goal achieving. It has to do something. It has to do object recognition or translation or theorem proving or navigation, or its intelligence is not very high. Better yet, it does it in more than one domain. So it does all those things like we do. You know, you can play the guitar, you can get in your car and drive, you can call your French girlfriend and speak French on the phone as you're driving to your chess match. That's a unique thing. So intelligence is about expertise in domains, the more the better, and learning. Mm. All the animals in the world are born with all the abilities they'll ever have, not you. Mm. You can learn new languages, new ways of living. You can learn to meditate. You can learn new skills that take a lifetime to master. So all that together is human level intelligence. What we've achieved so far are a very powerful, narrow intelligence. We've achieved those things, including machine learning, without the multi-domain aspect. And that's what makes it a very, very powerful technology.
So James, give us an example of a breakthrough in AI that starts to alarm you or raise awareness around the positive or the negative aspects of AI.
Well, we've seen in the short term, we've seen bad actors use AI in a harmful way. One thing that really worries me is the development of autonomous battlefield robots and drones. And these are weapons that kill without a human in the loop, that make the kill decision. These are being developed right now. They're on the proving grounds. They're out of the lab. They'll soon be on the battlefields. That's a very bad road to go down, because it leads to massive wars with machines killing humans.
Mm. And this is just game theory right now. They haven't really applied it in the battlefield, have they?
You know, it was many years. The CIA was conducting a war with drones over Central Asia for many years before we found out about it. It would not support. There are autonomous weapons. There are autonomous defensive weapons over Israel right now. There are autonomous weapon systems protecting battleships. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't surprise me to learn that there were autonomous drones flying around finding targets and killing them. It would not surprise me one bit if that were already happening. So this isn't theoretical. This is out of the lab. There are 56 nations developing battlefield robots. The most sought after will be those that kill without a human in the loop, that make the kill decision, that recognize somebody and assassinate them.
So James, is it the technology itself, or is the technology in the hands of certain institutions or governments that concerns you the most?
It's absolutely the technology in the hands of people. AI is fascinating because as I said before, it's the deepest look we've ever had at ourselves. It probes, it studies neuroscience. How do our brains work? Artificial neural nets are based roughly on our brains.
Yeah, explain that. What's a neural net?
It's not an easy explanation, but a neural net is, we've learned that you can take a massive amount of data, feed it into a simple learning algorithm, and get results at processes that are better than hand-coded programs. So if you take a lot of simple learning algorithms and stack them up, you've got basically a network of tiers of algorithms that act like roughly like neurons.
So that's a framework for machine learning.
That's a species of machine learning. That's a type of machine learning. And machine learning is one of the aspects of artificial intelligence. There are many others. So that big data is, as they say, it's the new oil, because you need a lot of data to use neural nets. But neural nets are not the only tool. But right now, they're the really hot tool. And they've actually been around for 30 years. But what's happened recently is, A, the availability of big data to feed them. B, better techniques, these algorithms, these simple learning algorithms that you put in a tier and create deep learning systems. And C, better processors. We're using graphical processors, GPUs, instead of just CPUs, central processing units. And now coming out are AI-specific processors, which will radically accelerate the whole thing.
So speed and complexity.
Data, better processors, better techniques have led to this revolution in AI right now, which is attracting huge amounts of money, which has has applications in virtually any industry or any business. Anything that's using digital information can benefit from AI.
And then, of course, there's that crossover point in time. I think Kurzweil refers to 2029, when the processing power of the computer surpasses that of the human brain. It moves, but this is the fear point. This is where people are starting to say, once that happens, by virtue of what you've just pointed out, these capabilities brought together, now we're in a different realm of existence or extinction. Yeah. Is that right?
Well, let me break it down into a couple of steps that we can understand. One is called one idea that's central to this premise is called the intelligence explosion, and that was an idea that came out in the 1960s. It was created by a statistician named I.J. Goode, who incidentally had worked at Bletchley Park with Alan Turing during the war to break the Enigma codes. Fascinating character. He said, once we create machines that are smarter than us, they'll be better than us at everything that we do, including making smart machines. It's that simple. Thereafter, the machines will set the pace of the intelligence of intelligence expansion and growth, not humans. And within a couple of generations of machines, which happened very fast, those machines will eclipse our intelligence by 1,000 or 1,000,000 times. So when will we have the basic recipe or the basic ingredients necessary for the intelligence explosion? That comes at a time when we have a computer that is as intelligent as we are in many domains and has general intelligence. Then, and another way to look at it is this. We've created machines that are better than us at a lot of things. IBM's Watson does better business analysis. It recognizes cancer cells better. There's a bunch of examples where they plays Go, they play Jeopardy. They do lots of things that formerly we did only. In the not too distant future, we'll create machines that do AI research and development better than we do. That's the intelligence explosion.
I'm Steve Stein. You're listening to my conversation with James Barrett, filmmaker and author of Our Final Invention. In the first part of the program, we talked about the so-called intelligence explosion. That's the point at which a computer is able to replicate itself better than human beings can. It's a clear and present danger, but for some reason, it's not something we hear about that often. Why is the dystopia downside of AI getting so little attention? That's the question I put to James.
Primarily, I think the problem is with businesses. They only tout the good side, and they're only looking at quarterly reports. They're not looking at the long-term downstream impacts on, say, employment, which are going to be huge for AI. AI is replacing many, many jobs right now. They're not looking at the impact of having autonomous battlefield robots and drones, but they're developing the technologies that will lead to these things.
Not because they're benevolent, you know, we are going to use our resources to produce a better outcome for humanity. We're talking about profit motive.
Totally profit motive. I mean, you know, all the corporations that are developing AI, there's not one whose hands are really clean. I mean, ethically, these guys are they're all over the place.
Well, that's a big statement. I mean, are you saying that based on past performance or behaviors, or are you just saying because they're basically children playing with guns?
Well, Demis Hassabis is the founder and co-founder and CEO of DeepMind, probably the leading AI company. He said that he's afraid that the big tech giants, when we approach the intelligence explosion, will not get together to cooperate, to lessen its impact, to try to control the rate of intelligence expansion. He said that because these companies have done bad things. Google, for example, has been sued in 20 countries for everything from predatory business practices to copyright violations to not paying their taxes. Apple's been using Foxconn, Chinese the industrial manufacturer that has, you know, working conditions are so bad there. In 2010, 14 people killed themselves. Foxconn's response was to stop reporting about suicides. Facebook just sold all our data to Cambridge Analytica, which sold it to Russia, which influenced an election. So all of these people are motivated solely by profit. They're paying lip service to ethics and accountability. And here's the key idea. AI is not like other technologies. It's not like making Legos. It's not like making cars. AI is the technology that will invent technology. It's what we call a dual use technology, capable of great good and great harm. And a great example of that is nuclear fission. In the 1920s and 30s, we thought of nuclear fission as a way to split the atom and get free energy. Then this period of utopia would follow. But what happened with fission? It was quickly weaponized. We incinerated two cities full of people. Then we held a gun to our own heads for 60 years, and it's still at our heads.
With the arms race.
With the nuclear arms race, and with the mutually assured destruction policy. And we came very close to making ourselves extinct several times. AI is tracking fission very closely. Yeah. It's already being weaponized. It's in the hands of several actors of very questionable ethics. And we're not anticipating future outcomes.
So if we have historical evidence that we tend to run amok, yeah, and not really learn from these mistakes, and now we're looking forward into the possibilities and potential of AI, they talk about the fourth industrial revolution and, yeah, AI being at the cusp of that, or really the center of that, the real game changer for countries, for nations, for corporations. You're asking the question, why aren't we contemplating and debating these very serious issues and setting up a framework, a regulatory framework, to safeguard ourselves and the future of humanity?
If we're going to survive the next 50 to 60 years, we have to set up an organization that demands transparency of people developing advanced AI. And this is not a controversial idea. This is the smart thing to do. If you were experiencing fission again, starting to do fission again, you would probably develop a maintenance plan. There was no maintenance plan for fission. That's why we've almost killed ourselves with it so many times. A species stupid enough to almost kill themselves with fission is not going to survive a more sensitive technology. AI is a more sensitive technology.
Yeah,
we've got to get on it now. I'm happy to say that a bunch of organizations, not-for-profits, have popped up. The Future of Humanity Institute out of Oxford, the Future of Life Institute from it's kind of organized around MIT, but Max Tegmark runs that. MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. These are pretty well-funded not-for-profits who are working on these problems. And these organizations, except for MIRI, didn't exist even 5 years ago.
And these are advocacy groups, but really without teeth. At the end of the day, they can't hold anybody accountable unless everyone agrees, which you are arguing is highly unlikely.
You know, what the Future of Life Institute's been really good at is getting AI makers together with ethicists and then having people sign statements. They had a lot of AI makers sign a statement saying, I'm not going to work on autonomous killing machines.
What does that mean, though? How do you actually then put that into action?
Well, you get everybody to sign it. If you get all the brains, all the leading AI makers to agree not to do this, they won't do it.
Yeah.
And so, and then there's really nobody else. You know, you could then every new generation of PhD, you get them to sign it. You talk to them, you bring them on board, you talk to them about technology, you educate them in this aspect of ethics, which isn't really being taught in the schools. Yeah. And then hopefully you can persuade them not to be a dupe for the corporations and develop these dangerous technologies.
But then again, you know, that's voluntary. At the end of the day, there's the greed factor. And if somebody waves, you know, a couple million dollars in front of you and you're a young postgraduate and you walk out and say, I actually have the ambition to do something, and frankly, it's wide open because nobody else is going to touch it. Well, human experience suggests that there will be a few rogues who decide to go that path.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. Eliezer Yudkowsky is one of the big thinkers in this space. He and Nick Bostrom have been working on this since around 2000. And he said, the danger isn't the technology. The danger is people wanting to feel important. It's that simple. They want to feel important. People want to get, they want to get graduate degrees and get good jobs. They want to get tenure. They want things. And that's far more dangerous than the technology, which is really very clever and very interesting. Mm. It's just people's desire to feel important.
Well, and talk about looking at the data, future jobs, data scientists, big data analysts, AI technologists, yeah. engineers. These guys are pushing the highest ends of postgraduate salaries.
That's right. They're getting there's a new AI PhD gets between $300,000 and $500,000, which is incredible. It's like the NBA stars. And I think in one way, I think that's great because AI has such terrific potential to do good, such huge potential to do good, but it has to be developed. See, this is why the IAEA exists, the International Atomic Energy Agency. They have a mandate to go into silos and to go into nuclear power plants and make sure that things are running according to international law.
And it took 20 years before they brought that together, right?
It took a long time, yeah. But now it's pretty effective. And if you don't comply, you get sanctions. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always work, but it works most of the time. And then you get some rogue nations like North Korea that just thumb their nose at the regulations, but they get their pants sanctioned off. Mm-hmm. So if we need that regulation, I'm never one to say government regulation is a good idea, but in this case, it's an absolute necessity.
Let's talk a little bit. We talk about corporations, and you've just alluded to governments. Let's talk about governments and the geopolitics of AI. There's global competition to be leaders in AI. The United States, with Silicon Valley and all of its kind of educational capabilities, has been driving this, but quickly catching up is China and India and Russia, which are two or three that have been called out recently. I read that China is looking to build an industry approximately $150 billion by the year 2030, which is a substantial investment. Oh, yeah. And this is China Inc. joining forces with its own private entities like Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, and others. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Well, when a country says we're going to dominate AI by 2030, which China has said, it makes me anxious because it suggests it's already using the rhetoric of the Cold War. It's already using the rhetoric of an arms race. And that's very sobering. And then Vladimir Putin, as if to answer China, said he came out and said AI is not important just for Russia, but for the world. Whoever controls AI controls the world. Mm. So there's a terrific intelligence race going on right now among the major players. And there's also a huge first mover advantage to the person who crosses the line and makes a super intelligent machine first.
So this is the fear of militarization of AI, but yeah. Just like the first, second, and third industrial revolution, combustion engine, and other things that came from those eras, this could actually be the application of AI to manage more efficiently the available power we have in a nation around the world. Again, there's wonderful positive outcomes from this, but your fear is that governments will default into more of a power play as opposed to, applying AI to drive the potential of an industry.
I don't have very many examples of governments doing anything effectively. I don't see the governments do not invent technology. They don't make technology better. They can invest in technology. DARPA is a giant funder of AI, but DARPA doesn't create anything. Mm-hmm. China is a giant funder of AI, but ultimately it's going to be individuals with a lot of expertise who are making the AI. And I tend to see them coming out of corporations.
But funding can be maligned based on government interests. So, issue a $10 to $20 million grant towards a corporation that's working on some aspect of AI, you're going to get support for that. And you're going to have R&D moving in that direction. We saw that in the United States with the development of the pharmaceutical industry, with the development of the internet, with DARPA. Yeah. China is now clearly stated, openly and transparently, we will be participants in this next generation, in this next industrial revolution.
Well, what I think China has to understand, and what anyone looking to be the leader in this has to understand, is they have to be a leader in ethics at the same time. Mm. They have to be a standard bearer for the highest ethical standards for using this technology. They can't use this technology in manipulative ways. They can't make victims out of this technology. They can't use this technology to increase the gulf between rich and poor. They have to use this technology to help empower the least able. China has a great opportunity, as does every country who's playing with or developing AI, has a great opportunity to set an example of stewardship. Our problem as humans is our innovation runs way ahead of our stewardship. We make terrible mistakes, and then we go, oh, gee, here's how we patch that up. Well, AI isn't like a bomb. You know, you drop a bomb and then you clean up the mess. If we create machines that are super intelligent, that are much more intelligent than we are, there's no turning them off. There's no cleaning them up. It's an accident that never ends.
James, it's dire. I mean, this feels dire. I mean, as a student of history, as somebody who's observed this, and as a philosophy major from the day, you know, you actually are bringing to bear a lot of those aspects of humanity that you don't think are going to bear out effectively, and therefore, you know, leave us with not many options except to ultimately clean up that mess. But you're saying this mess could be beyond cleaning up.
No, if we create a super intelligent machine, there's no way we can, and we don't know how to control it, there's no way to stop it. There's just no way to stop it.
I got to find the silver thread in here somewhere. What can we hope for? Best case scenario, what would you like? Or what do you think is possible? Not what you think can happen, because you've been very clear on that, but what is actually practically possible given what you know about this?
What's practically possible is for organizations to get together and do what the Future of Life Institute wants. And that means be transparent. Get together with ethicists, have ethicists on your board, have ethicists baked into your technology from the beginning. Make sure your technology is not being used for bad things. And we all know what bad things are. And you know, everyone makes excuses about realpolitik and how the real world works. Well, this is like fission. This is something that's so deadly, so dangerous. The silver lining is we have an opportunity as a species to define ourselves as an ethical species that wants to survive. We're talking about our survival. We're talking about the generations that come after us. If we don't get this right in this development window, before we get to human level intelligence and machine, there will be no more generations.
How much time do we have before to get this institutions in place in order to be able to anticipate some of the challenges that we face?
It's very, very hard to say. And, you know, I've been asked the question a lot of times, when do we get to the intelligence explosion? When do we get to smarter than human machines? And, you know, I've done polls. I've taken part in polls. The mean date is 2045, but I think everyone would agree at this point that we'll probably get there faster than that. But it's really hard to guess the future. Mm-hmm. Things happen fast in technology. You know, for example, DeepMind defeated the best Go champions, and that was something that wasn't supposed to happen for 10 years. And
yeah, Go, tell us quickly about Go.
Sure. Go is an Asian board game of strategy and tactics that's an order of magnitude more complex than chess. It's said there are more possible board positions in Go than there are grains of sand in the world. That gives you some idea of how complex it is. Well,
it's not like checkers.
It's like checkers on steroids, right. You know, plus speed. Yeah. They thought it was going to be a long time before machine beat Go. But then DeepMind created a deep learning system called AlphaGo Zero, where they used a bunch of simple learning algorithms. The data they fed it were great games, thousands of games of Go. And they used an old technique called reinforcement learning. And they beat the Go champions in about a week. In a series of games, they defeated the Go champions. Then they built something called AlphaGo Zero, which boggles my mind and makes me think about the intelligence explosion. AlphaGo Zero never saw a game of Go. It never had the games to study and to do pattern recognition on, which is what neural nets do. It never had any games. It played against itself. So it divided into two teams in itself. It played against itself and its big data component were the games it played. And it improved its own performance exponentially by playing thousands upon thousands of games. Learning from scratch, from zero, knowing the rules and never seeing a game. Within I think it was 72 hours, it was better than any human or computer Go player.
So these are indications of how quickly AI development is occurring. And if anybody thinks it's going to be further off, it's probably coming faster than expected.
Yeah, objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. Mm-hmm. Now, but to put this in a more human perspective, there are 200 engineers behind this technology, 200 top of class PhDs in AI. So this didn't just happen. This is not a technology that develops itself. And so we hope that, I mean, the hope is that wherever there's a room full of AI makers, there are enough of them who are saying, you know what, this application is exploitive. Mm-hmm. or this application is wonderful. Let's do this application instead of this application. Let's not develop these machines to kill people. Let's develop these machines to cure cancer, or do climate modeling, or investigate pharmaceuticals. You know, to look up new, to create new drugs.
I'm trying to think of another example in time, history, society, where an oath has been taken to protect. It might be among the medical profession.
I'll give you one. The Asilomar conference in the 1970s, the people who were working on recombinant DNA thought, uh-oh, this could get dangerous. We could pollute the environment. Let's get together. They went to the Asilomar Conference Center in California, and they made up basic rules of lab safety for recombinant DNA, like don't track the DNA out on your shoes. Mm-hmm. Don't take it out into the environment. We don't know what's going to happen. So now, you know, 50 years later, we're getting really good DNA therapies, or genetic medicine. We've used genetic medicine before in simpler forms, but right now we're curing real diseases.
And people have adhered to those protocols to make sure that the DNA is managed effectively.
Yes, and they update them and they adhere to them. So that's a great example. And they're governed more or less by the market. If you have a failure in genetic medicine, as has happened, they've had a couple of tragedies. They had a young man died. A group of people, a group of people died 10, 15 years ago. The industry was chastened, and the governing bodies like the FDA clamped down. And so when the new, I was just involved in a film about one of these technologies, and they came out of their dark period and with new rules and new protocols. Mm. Now, what they had was a survivable accident. They had an accident that didn't kill everybody and it didn't destroy the industry. With AI, it's harder to contemplate a survivable accident when we're talking about super intelligent machines.
I almost had you ending on a positive note there, James, but it looks at the end of the day that even with we're talking about the end of time. We're talking about that moment when a technology like nothing we've seen before really is going to throw itself up in front of us and challenge us to either perpetuate our existence or to fade away in favor of machines.
You know, one theory about why we haven't ever been contacted by another species is because of an idea called the great filter. And it goes like this. Great species don't last long because they invent machine intelligence.
Well, on that note, I want to say thank you for spending your time and thank you for all the dark, nightmarish dreams I'll be having in the weeks and months to come. James, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure, Steve.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. That was my interview with James Barrett, filmmaker, futurist, and author of the book, Our Final Invention. Now for the Asia Insider Minute, that time in the program where I offer up some thoughts of my own on the exchange we've just heard, or sometimes just end with a question. This week, it's the latter. And here's my question, or at least the first of them. How far away are we from the intelligence explosion? 10 years? 50 years? 3/4 of a century? As with all things tech, there's the prospect of acceleration. And in the case of AI, that means we humans may not be ready. Smart Money says we're closer than we think, or as little as 2 decades away from the proverbial crossover point where the human mind is surpassed by the processing power of machines. In other words, the distance between us and the intelligence explosion is like Nixon to Reagan, or the Beatles to U2. Blink once, and we've arrived. Blink twice, and it's too late. Time will answer the first question, but that leads us to the second. When the moment arrives, will we be able to control it? Or in Barrett's words, are we looking at a handover or a takeover? Like James the Baptist, our guest heralds the coming of something bigger than ourselves. Prepare ye the way of the bot. To be ready, it appears that baptism in the name of ethics is our last and best hope. And that brings me to the last question. In these times of rampant corporate competition and geopolitical intrigue, what real expectations can we have for agreeing on the ground rules for AI development and deployment? It's all well and good to get wrapped up in the promise of advanced technology and herald science as the vanguard of human existence, but like every great journey, it's wise to take precautions. Prepare for the future now, or there may be no future to speak of. On that dark note, I thank you for listening. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.